It's the TED Radio Hour from NPR. I'm Anoush Zamarodi. On the show today, future you. And so far, we've talked about our relationship to ourself, singular. But what about our collective connection to the future, to generations to come? How do we as societies form a relationship to people that we will never know?
There's some sense that as long as you do your own future planning, perhaps you'll be okay and the people you know will be okay in the future. But it's not enough to just keep your family healthy and safe. There's something about using history and using our collective memory that's really important when it comes to collectively planning for the future.
This is Bina Venkatraman.
I'm a columnist at the Washington Post, and my book is The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age.
Before she wrote her book, Bina was working in the Obama administration as a science advisor, helping mayors, governors, corporate executives think through their planning for future disasters.
There was a sense that this sounds really important, but at the moment, my board is basically focused on how we're going to do our quarterly earnings report, what kind of stock dividends we're going to be paying, very short-term oriented metrics. People just couldn't seem to take these threats of the future that seriously.
This led Bina on a search to understand why some societies succeed and others fail to plan for their future. In 2017, she went to Fukushima, Japan.
It was the sixth anniversary of the nuclear disaster there at Fukushima Daiichi, the nuclear plant, where the tsunamis had breached the seawall of the nuclear reactor.
Teetering on what looks like a meltdown. After the quake and the tsunami, a blast at the Daiichi nuclear power plant in Fukushima. Its sheer power, plain to see.
Well, experts are warning that radiation levels now are rising at the Fukushima nuclear plant. And there is a high.
In 2011, a magnitude 9 earthquake hit Japan, causing massive tsunamis, one of which flooded the nuclear plant in Fukushima. Chemical explosions damaged surrounding buildings. Smoke was everywhere.
And so this disaster led to a meltdown of the nuclear reactors and displaced hundreds of thousands of people. And we could see cracks in the walls of the stairwells still from the earthquake 6 years before. There were still more than 100,000 people in 2017, 6 years later, displaced by that nuclear disaster. One of the things that was so interesting to think about and learn was how the company that ran the nuclear power plant, TEPCO, how they had thought about planning for the future at the time.
TEPCO had done a risk analysis, but it hadn't looked far enough into the past.
And what was interesting to learn was the high contrast between what happened in Fukushima and what happened in Onagawa, Japan, in 2011. When I was there, I learned about the Onagawa nuclear power station, which was even closer to the epicenter of that earthquake than the infamous Fukushima Daiichi that we all know about.
Here's Bina Venkatraman on the TED stage.
In Onagawa, people in the city actually fled to the nuclear power plant as a place of refuge. It was that safe. It was spared by the tsunamis. It was the foresight of just one engineer, Yanosuke Hirai, that made that happen. In the 1960s, he fought to build that power plant farther back from the coast, at higher elevation and with a higher seawall. He knew the story of his hometown shrine, which had flooded in the year 869 after a tsunami. It was his knowledge of history that allowed him to imagine what others could not.
869.
Yes, yeah. That's 1,000 years, more than 1,000 years before, you have a tsunami that floods a shrine, and the story gets carried forward, the Jogan earthquake of 869. So there was a marker in his hometown shrine, and there are actually markers in other areas of Japan that have survived from that particular earthquake. So there's a place called Murahama, where on the top of a particular hill, in 869, people had fled to the top of that hill, thinking that was a safe place during an earthquake, given the risk of tsunami, to flee. And in fact, it was one of the worst places you could go, because two tsunamis
sort of two big waves crested over the hill and killed the people who had fled to the top of this hill. And so the people who survived this disaster, who weren't on the top of the hill, decided to mark that place and to have that marker stay intact and the story of it taught to local school children and sort of passed on through the generations.
So part of this future planning is taking the long view backwards and forwards.
Yeah. So one of the principles here is that when we're planning for the future, it's not helpful to only look at what's just happened. And it's very much in human psychology to respond to whatever risk or disaster has just befallen us. So for example, right after Fukushima, Japan actually cut a lot of its nuclear capacity in part over safety concerns. But the net effect of that was a turn to natural gas, LNG, and more fossil fuels, which, as we know, is contributing to climate change. And other countries of the world have similarly reacted to what happened in Fukushima and pulled back on nuclear power. And that is an example of, I think, sometimes how we can overreact to events that happen in recent historical memory.
Can we talk about another example of governments having to deal with figuring out our collective future for people who won't be alive when this finally does happen? And you talk about this a little bit in your book, nuclear waste, because this is, you know, where you dispose of this stuff. It doesn't go away, does it? Is that forcing certain political leaders to really think generations ahead?
You know, nuclear waste is one of those challenges that is similar to the climate crisis in that the time horizon in which people today are implicated is far longer than we're used to contemplating and we're used to imagining. So we're actually obligated to those future generations that are going to live in a world that we have warmed with our decisions about how we use energy. And with nuclear waste, there have been a number of efforts to try to say, how should we imagine if we create a nuclear waste site, marking that for future generations, knowing that languages change, that the oldest living languages are only a few thousand years old, and some of the time horizons of this waste often extends much farther into the future?
Can you share some of the ideas that came up? Some of them are really funny in your book.
There have been really interesting cabals that have been brought together to think about the nuclear waste question. An example that I love to talk about in this realm is genetically engineering cats whose fur will turn green around nuclear waste sites. The idea being that since cats were loved in ancient Egypt and are loved today, they'll probably be loved by future humans. And some of these ideas just really expose the futility of trying to really intimately know future generations. So even things like trying to make a signal. You would think, okay, we can mark this as a hazardous waste site and put a skull and crossbones there. Well, that could also mark like a pirate theme park. It doesn't have to be something that's hazardous, right? So we don't know what people 10,000 years from now are going to want or like or do. But what we can do is we can pass things on that are carried on by each generation to come and explain their importance, explain their value to that next generation, and hope that that next generation then adapts and brings that message forth, carrying the torch to the next one.
It sounds like what you're saying is to connect to our future collective selves, we have to see these new generations as real people, and we need to see ourselves as future generations for previous generations in some way. We have to see ourselves as part of a continuum.
Absolutely. I really believe in this way of thinking about ourselves. We all want to feel like we belong to something greater, and what greater thing to belong to than the fabric of time?
In the winter of 2012, I went to visit my grandmother's house in South India, a place, by the way, where the mosquitoes have a special taste for the blood of the American born. No joke. When I was there, I got an unexpected gift. It was this antique instrument, made more than a century ago, hand-carved from a rare wood, inlaid with pearls and with dozens of metal strings. It's a family heirloom, a link between my past, the country where my parents were born, and the future, the unknown places I'll take it. I didn't actually realize it at the time I got it, but it would later become a powerful metaphor for my work. It was custom made for my great-grandfather. He was a well-known music and art critic in India in the early 20th century. My great-grandfather had the foresight to protect this instrument at a time when my great-grandmother was pawning off all their belongings, but that's another story. He protected it by giving it to the next generation, by giving it to my grandmother, and she gave it to me. When I first heard the sound of this instrument, it haunted me. It felt like hearing a wanderer in the Himalayan fog. It felt like hearing a voice from the past. This instrument is in my home today, but it doesn't actually belong to me. It's my role to shepherd it in time. And that feels more meaningful to me than just owning it for today. This instrument positions me as both a descendant and an ancestor. It makes me feel part of a story bigger than my own. And this, I believe, is the single most powerful way we can reclaim foresight. By seeing ourselves as the good ancestors we long to be. Ancestors not just to our own children, but to all humanity. Whatever your heirloom is, however big or small, protect it. And know that its music can resonate for generations.
That was Beena Venkatraman. Her book is called The Optimist Telescope, Thinking Ahead in a Reckless Age. You can see her talk at TED.com.